Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to the Modern Learners Podcast. If you're someone who's in a position of educational leadership or who someday aspires to be, and you enjoy diving deep into learning and innovation, we invite you to join us in Modern Learners' newest community, Change Leaders. I'm Lynn Hill, the community manager of CLC, and our space can help ensure you're using your professional learning time to the fullest. CLC offers carefully curated content to help you find signal among the noise, thought-provoking questions and discussions with inspiring community members who are serious about change, live events and access to the Modern Learners team, and a circle of critical friends who will help you kick off change efforts in your schools. Visit changeleaders.community to check out a free 30-day trial and join in our movement. And I look forward to learning with you.
Some of our subjects are 6 months long or one semester long, and some of them are whole year subjects. And they're basically divided into what we call student-led electives, where the student knows that it'll be around a topic, you know, for instance, your geek studies or the science of warfare. So you know that it's about warfare, but it's a student-led elective. So what they do within that subject is pretty much open to the student to negotiate with the staff member.
Everyone, and welcome back to Modern Learners Podcast. Great that you're able to join with us again. The voice you just heard was from Peter Hutton, the recently retired principal from Templestowe College here in Victoria, Australia. Templestowe College, or TC as it's now known, was a school built for about 1,000 students, but when Peter Hutton walked into the school in 2010, there were just over 200 students still attending. The school had been facing some severe challenges, but Peter was up for the challenge. This podcast tells the story that Peter faced over the intervening 7 years and the assumptions that he tested in trying to create a better modern learning environment for students. And when you've got time, make sure you drop by our Change Leaders community at changeleaders.community, where you get a chance to join other leading professionals and change leaders and a diverse group of experts, where we explore what learning is and what it isn't and the gap between what we know and believe, how we learn best and what we actually do in schools. In the meantime, let's hear a little bit from Peter Hutton and the story at Templestowe College. So, Peter, can you take us back to when you came to Templestowe College, which you refer to and everyone refers to as TC? Yeah. Talk a little bit about the environment here when you came and the transition that you went through.
So part of the reason that we do call it TC is that the school had a terrible name when we started, and we really in some ways did want to rebrand it. And, you know, so a little like KFC, for instance, we wanted to come up with something that was a bit sort of, you know, unique and a bit sort of more cutting edge. So we came up with the term TC, but the school had decreased from an enrollment of over 1,000 to 286 students. And we had 23 year sevens, so a little difficult to offer electives when you've got 23. You can have A or A, and then next semester you can have B or B. And so that sort of, in one way, everything was done for survival, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought the easiest way to get some students in is to make them enjoy their schooling. And so, you know, we asked the kids, if you could study anything in the world, what would it be? And initially, actually, they said things like art and, you know, technology and some cooking and things, you know, that sort of thing. And I've got, no, you're thinking conventionally, you're thinking, yep, like a school. I said, yep, if you could study anything, what would it be? So when we started, we said, if you could study anything in the world, what would it be? And the students initially came up with things like food technology and textiles and, you know, woodwork. And I said to them, no, you're thinking like a conventional school. So, you know, what would you really study if you could study anything in the world? You know, I didn't care if it was astronomy, astrology, it could be anything, you know, anything they were interested in. And their top response was computer gaming design. And so we actually started down that pathway and had a partnership with La Trobe University. But the second one was working with animals. And so basically I just went to the pet store, you know, a bit of an unusually pet store, and bought whatever we could. So we bought a snake and some rabbits and some, you know, some birds and some fish and all of that sort of thing. And that was pretty much how we started down that down that line. In terms of, you know, how we ended up moving towards no year levels and that sort of thing, again, that was simply because we, you know, you can't run electives with one class, but if you combine your year sevens and your year eights together, then we had two classes of year eight. So that meant I could offer, you know, three electives, and then, you know, we had three classes of year nine. So if you include those, then you can offer six electives per line. So, you know, literally a lot of the things, you know, even the working with animals program was based around, you know, the pedagogy behind that was essentially if you give a kid a white rabbit to pat, you have an enrollment, you know. So it was very much about survival in those first years.
So then how did that develop to the individualized program that you have today, and how does that actually function?
I think we just saw the benefits of, you know, when students are engaged and happy in the school, how much better they learn. And it's not only in the subjects that you might call, you know, fun and enjoyable, you know, provided that there's at least one, you know, preferably two things, two of those subjects that they really want to do and are passionate about. They sort of understand that school has to have some, you know, drudgery, to be honest. And so they're usually prepared to sort of suck up those other, you know, less palatable subjects. Because they know that it means that they can do, you know, geek studies, or they can do their sporting fitness classes, or, you know, elite art, or whatever the case might be. We really just started questioning assumptions, you know, assumptions around year levels, assumptions around, you know, can you have bells, you know, assumptions around is English a compulsory subject, is maths compulsory. And, you know, every time we questioned an assumption, we generally found that if we played around with that, we could come up with a better solution than the traditional system, you know, currently has. Yeah, so we just got a bit carried away, I think.
So logistically, how's that all structured, the individualised program? What choices do they have? How does that work out through a day, a week, a year?
So some people think that our timetable must be horrendous with that sort of level of subjects, but in fact, it's probably the reverse. It's, you know, it's not without its complications, but it's actually relatively simple. So we made common unit, which is every subject is three lots of 75 minutes per week. By doing that, it means that everything's basically in a block, you know, very similar to the senior part of any sort of most high schools. And so it means that you can't get clashes where, you know, you know a teacher can only access them for two out of the three lessons, or a student, you know, in order to do chemistry is missing one of their biology classes, etc. So, you know, everything is in a block. So we run six blocks. Everything's three lots of 75 minutes. Every student chooses six things to study. Increasingly, a lot of them are choosing to do one as either a private study or as a PLP, which is a personalised learning project, you know, where they're essentially self-managing during that time. What it means is for a lot of our students that they're able to, you know, really throw themselves into outside school activities, and that could be paid work, it could be sport, it could be music, performing in a band, working, you know, because they've got that one set of spares, if you will, they can do all their homework and their preparation and all of those sorts of things so that they can, you know, actually have a life. You know, I know it seems abhorrent that young people should actually enjoy those years, you know, between 12 and 18. It sort of almost seems like we're designing something that's, you know, deliberately unpleasant. It just does not make sense to me.
So they do, did you say they do six, they choose to do six subjects through each semester?
Yeah. Some of our subjects are 6 months long or one semester long, and some of them are whole year subjects. And they're basically divided into what we call student-led electives, where the student knows that it'll be around a topic, you know, for instance, your geek studies or the science of warfare. So you know that it's about warfare, but it's a student-led elective. So what they do within that subject is pretty much open to the student to negotiate with the staff member. And then other subjects are what we call curriculum specified electives. So, you know, that might be something like pre-biology, for instance, or pre-psychology, where there's an actual course that needs to be covered because it's actually then leading on to, you know, a year 11 or year 12 subject traditionally. So in the VCE. So in that case, the student can't specify what they want to do because otherwise they wouldn't be prepared for that next step. So students are very clear going in just how much control they're going to have in that class. But even in our VCE classes and our pre-VCE classes, wherever possible, students, we try and give them as much option as we can.
So what about the two questions that people come up with? And as you know, our podcasts are listened to by people around the world. And I think the two questions that people would have relate to the evidence or assessments that are required within that space and the response from parents.
If I start with the parent one, we, like all government high schools in Victoria, we do a parent opinion survey. We got our data back and it was the 95%, not percentile, but 95% of the parents surveyed, which is sort of, you know, I think it's 10 to 15% were either positive or very positive about the school. So, you know, I think fairly glowing in that regard. And, you know, we've got a probably also a slightly skewed population because we pick up more than our fair share of students that have, you know, had difficulties in other systems or it just hasn't worked or school refuses and things like that. We tend not to pick up kids that have got, you know, like bad behaviour and things like that just because, you know, it's not suited. Like, unless the student can demonstrate that they've got some ability to self-regulate, it's actually probably not a good environment and they need more structure about their learning. In terms of the outcomes, certainly I've got to say that I'm a bit over this concept of everything's got to be measured, and if it's not of, you know, if it's not measured, it's not of any value, and all of those sort of things. You can see good learning. Okay, we know our kids, and they're happy, they're engaged when they leave here, and whether it's a university pathway, whether it's starting their own business, whether it's going into a trade, they have far greater sense of who they are as a person, what their relative skills and weaknesses are, and, you know, a good idea of the sort of, you know, ultimate, you know, either employment or pastime or profession that they're going to go into, and they generally stick at it. So we're actually collating, and that's the only sort of data really that I'm interested in is, you know, how happy are they once they've left, and how successful are they making a transition, you know, later life. And we actually are tracking our students at the moment for 4 years when they leave.
That's great.
And we're just sort of yet to do the diagnostics on that, but anecdotally, just looking through the data that we have in already, our students don't drop out, like, you know, as a generalisation. So they're in Australia, the average course has 25% of kids drop out in the first year and a 50% non-completion rate for across the whole degree, you know, in very rough terms. Our kids just don't do that.
Yeah.
They really stick at stuff.
Now, you mentioned about businesses and work that they are doing. Can you talk a little bit about the businesses that develop and evolve from the work that students do in the school?
Yeah, within the school, we've got about, so the school's a population of around 1,000, just over. We try and employ at least 10% of our students each year. So they're actually paid employees helping to run the school. So they run our IT department, they assist in reception, they assist with the maintenance and emptying of bins, they assist with setup of furniture and equipment for events, they do our audio-visual. There's a catering. They even tutor other students. So, you know, we have some students who are really bright at maths and they're able to have one of their six subjects as a paid tutoring gig where they go into another class and actually tutor students in that class. We also have around 80 businesses that are anywhere from ideation to actual operation. And so we run a thing annually called Kids Tank, which is a little bit like that well-known TV show Shark Tank, where we offer $2,500 business startup grants where students can pitch for those. So we've had some students have started up their own clothing manufacturing businesses. Some students have started up their own photography businesses. We've had students breeding their own snakes and selling the progeny, catering businesses. Yeah, there's been a huge range of those businesses started. Some of them need very little support and, you know, we're just encouraging from the sidelines. Others need, you know, far more support.
So I've been with you for a couple of hours walking around the school, pretty much, well, it was unheralded, that's for sure, with the students and teachers. And the thing that strikes me, and Will and I talk about this a lot, is the tone or the culture of the school. The culture here is one of an openness and, above all, an extraordinary amount of respect between everyone. To be really honest with you, at times I had to think, is this person a teacher or a student? Mm. I didn't actually know which was which. How do you get that? Now, this is the sort of $64 question. Everyone talks about culture as if it's some magic wand. It isn't. It obviously takes time. What's your sense about it? Why you have that here at TC? What do you think are the underpinnings of it?
Well, I think we all know that, you know, culture top strategy every time. And I think that does come from the top, to be perfectly honest. So we have this thing called a one-person policy. So, and we're very overt with that. And one of the interesting things, we didn't really do that today when walking around, but if you ask our kids how things work, like the 10-minute rule, if you just said, you know, what's the 10-minute rule? You know, virtually any student would be able to say, well, teachers are not allowed to talk continuously for more than 10 minutes. If you ask them, what's the one-person policy, they'd be able to say, you know, well, regardless of who you are and what your role is in the school, whether you're 13 or 30, whether you're a first year out or a graduate student, everybody's treated with the same degree of respect. So I think, you know, we've got our yes as the default policy. So if any staff, student or parent has a suggestion or a request, the answer has to be yes, unless it takes too much time, too much money or negatively impacts on someone else. And so, those little things, those, if you like, cryptic sayings or comments, like the no yelling rule, nobody yells at anyone. Teachers aren't allowed to yell at students. Students aren't allowed to yell at teachers. And it's the student's definition as to whether they've been yelled at or not. So little things like that.
No bells.
Help students understand that they have rights, and those rights come with responsibilities, but they're the same rights as staff in the school have. We also try not to refer to generally to teachers. We try to just call them staff because, again, you know, schools are full of hierarchies, and, you know, somehow if you're an education support staff member, you're not seen as being of as equivalent value as like a teacher or that sort of thing. So we just try and do away with all that. You know, it means that, you know, I have no reserved car park at the front of the school. You know, I have no office. So I actually operate out of a bag. I have a boffice. And the room that we're sitting in now, which is called the Fishbowl, which is just off the main resource centre, which is a sort of very communal area, this office, you know, sometimes I'll come in here to have a meeting and there'll be two students in here doing their English language or their foreign language study, and they'll be on the phone and I have to find another place. So, you know, I can't just sort of, you know, pull rank and displace them. So, yeah, culture is an interesting thing. I think the other thing is, when I first became an assistant principal, one of the wise old hands in the school gave me some advice and said, if you want to get anywhere in this business, you back your staff. So even if we're in the wrong, you say that we're right and you back us to parents, you back us to other people, you know, etc. And I actually did that for a while, and for a long while actually, because I've been an assistant principal or principal now for 20 years, but I just sort of, when I started as principal here 8 years ago, I've gone, that's actually wrong, you know. And I said to the staff, if you're wrong, I'm going to call you on it, okay? And if I'm wrong, I'll admit that, or I invite you to call me on that. You know, we're not putting ourselves out there as perfect, you know, beings or anything like that. We need to model that we can make mistakes and we can say sorry and we can move on from that point. Anyone in the school, be it student, staff or parent, can always appeal any decision, and that has to be like a guilt-free appeal. So we've got two principals. I share the principalship with another person, and if I make a mistake, somebody can appeal to the other principal. And we know that it has to be, you know, balance of probability, 50% even scales, so to speak.
So finally, and you've been very generous with your time, really appreciate it, and I know we've hopefully learned a lot, people listening to the podcast, I certainly have, and I'd love to keep connected with you and the work that you're doing, because I know you are moving on from here next year, but I know you have some ideals about the work that you've done here that you'll hopefully be sharing with other schools. So as a final question, I'm wondering if I can jump into that space, and I know you have a lot of people visit the school, both locally from overseas, a lot of people have come here. Mm-hmm. Where do they start? Where does someone who comes to the school and says, I like what I see, but I'd like to know, how do I start moving in that direction? Where do you start? Where do you suggest to people that they start?
I guess that's an interesting question. We've tried to scale this because we didn't want to be some sort of a skyrocket that, you know, did you know, pretty good things and then just burnt, faded to black and were never heard of again. And so we've deliberately partnered with other schools. So we've got Mount Alexander College, Bundoora Secondary College, Playford International School in Adelaide and Beechworth Secondary College, and they're all at various stages of sort of implementing this sort of student empowerment type model. But to be honest, probably five schools is as much as we can do while I'm, you know, still, you know, having a say in the running of this one in TC. And so that's actually what's precipitated me resigning and leaving the department and all forms of paid employment, so to speak, because I think I need to be free to help scale this. We've seen other schools, like the schools that I mentioned there, came and had a look at what we did. And then, you know, they've all got their own context. We're not trying to plant little TCs everywhere, but they have to look at it, take which parts, and then implement them in their own context. And I would hate if we got to the point where we had this model and it was take it or leave it, this is the whole model, because I think there's a great thrill in building your own model with your own students and staff and parents. I think that's the secret. That's what keeps it fresh. That's what, you know, that way, even, you know, when I go to some of those schools now, I see things and go, that's awesome. How did we not see that? You know, and so it becomes like a cross-pollination. It was a difficult gig as the one-off, and I would strongly recommend that people don't just launch into it and have a crack by themselves. I would suggest that they either make contact, you know, with Templestowe or the other schools that I've mentioned, or you can contact me directly, Hutton Consulting, their little plug, and just get some advice. And because, like, there are so many little, you know, things that we learnt along the way that could just make the road a little bit straighter for others.
And as a post-final question, if there is such a thing, it's probably a good place to wind up the discussion. You mentioned, as you come into the school, you have your current vision there, and you mentioned that the new vision has evolved. Can you just talk a little bit about that? And there's a particular word in that I know you explained to me you think is critical in that process.
So when we started this process 8 years ago, I got the job on the basis of selling the vision to the selection panel, and that was to be a dynamic and caring learning community recognised for future-focused, personalised learning. And then our current vision, to be a supportive community empowering students to manage their individualized learning and turn their ideas into reality. So that was our one for the last 4 years, and that was actually developed by a student who rode a lot of the school buses on his way home and actually asked students for their input. And our new one is to co-construct high-quality learning experiences within an inclusive and supportive community. I, up until starting here, I used to be so cynical of vision statements and mission statements and all of those sort of things, because, you know, you went through this long and involved, torturous process of deciding on wordage, and then, you know, pretty much that was, you know, it until 4 years later. But I really believe that those visions have guided us along the pathway. We are, and we've got a philosophy statement which is pretty damn good as well, in my view. And what we often say is we're philosophically strong but administratively loose. So, you know, we know 100% what we're wanting to achieve. Sometimes we just let ourselves down because we're humans.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Peter Hutton. It's been a pleasure visiting you here at the school, and I certainly wish you well in all the work you're doing in the future, and hopefully we get a chance to work together in the near future.
No worries. Thanks very much, Bruce.